All right, tonight we are going to look at a section of Ephesians that either gets me great applause or gets a bunch of people angry with me, depending on the crowd and who I'm talking to. So you guys, please, no one in the class rush the podium. And anybody listening on CD or the web, please don't write letters to Bob at Hadavar. Actually, if you don't like what I'm teaching, remember to write the letters. My name is Bob Morris. If you're upset with me, remember, I'm Bob Morris. We ended last week at the end of verse 21 there in chapter 5 with the phrase that, well, going back to 20, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another in the fear of God. And we ended that section in 5 where we were talking about how Paul has said we're to walk in wisdom, and that wisdom, walking in wisdom, is a reliance on the Spirit. And we looked at the idea that Paul said, you know, here, for example, is what this looks like. Instead of getting drunk, you should be filled with the Spirit, filled by the Spirit. And so instead of having alcohol alter your consciousness, you should have the Holy Spirit alter your consciousness. And what this looks like when this happens is there in verse 19, what this being filled by the Spirit looks like is speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father. Now, my idea on that is that that's how we live when we're filled by the Spirit, but that really is a picture of how we live in community. That's how we live at church. I mean, to make this modern application here. I don't usually, when I'm hanging out with my friends, my Christian friends, we don't usually sit around and spend the evening with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Normally we're watching a baseball game. And so although there's some good spiritual songs at baseball games, I'm not discounting that. There you go. Well, you know, baseball is biblical, right? Creation began during a baseball game, right? In Genesis, in the big inning, God created the heaven and earth, right? And Jesus talks about baseball. He was with one of the players' wives, right? He met that woman at the well with the pitcher. How am I doing on this? Am I doing? There should be a drum ba-da-ba behind me, right? It's like bad vaudeville in here tonight. But this is sort of stuff that we do corporately. I sort of say that the application of this is kind of how we are when we're together at church or in a small group or in a Bible study or whatnot. And so this idea of subjecting ourselves to one another in the fear of God really is, again, this corporate picture. This is how we're to act. This is how Spirit-filled people act when they're walking in wisdom. But then what Paul does is he's going to now take this and he's going to say, this is what it looks like when we're in community, but here's what it looks like when we're one-on-one. Here's what it looks like when we're together in an individual basis, not in a corporate setting, not in a church setting. And Paul is going to take the three most common relationships that we have in life. The relationship of husband and wife. And I've preached on this passage in church before, and I've always said that this also applies, I believe, by extension, a modified version, to dating relationships, and even to friendships that I think we can apply this. But primarily Paul is talking about relationships, husband and wife. The second most common type of relationship that we run into that Paul talks about is that of parent and child. Okay, and all of us here, by the fact that we're here, means that we're a child, right? We had to have a parent at some point. Not everybody that reads this part is a parent and has children of their own, but we at least get one half of the equation. And then the third one, Paul talks about in the text, it talks about slaves and masters. That's a really difficult concept for us to look at for two reasons. One, that just doesn't exist in our society anymore. We don't have that paradigm. And number two, particularly here in America, that's an extremely a loaded area to look at because we had the brutal history of slavery here in America. So the way I think that we need to approach that, and I don't believe this is a cop-out, quite frankly, I think this is a very valid application, I think we look at that as employer-employee relationships. Because I think that's the closest thing we have in our society, in America, to match what Paul is talking about there. So, and I'll talk about these as we get to these sections. But I think what's happening here is Paul is saying, okay, you're to be filled by the Spirit, and you're to walk wisely, and you're to live, and you're to have these relationships, and here's what the picture looks like on a corporate level, here's what it looks like at church, here's what it looks like when you're gathering together as a group, but now here's what it looks like for individuals. This is really now the absolute rubber meets the road application. Here's what this looks like in relationship. And the key that Paul does here is 21, subjecting yourself to one another in the fear of God. That is the overarching idea for this entire section. That's mutual submission. Now, why is this so important? At verse 22, Paul has a break. But this is the only real break throughout the book of Ephesians where Paul doesn't put some sort of conjunction. All the other ones, you know, he has this, he'll say, right, therefore, or in light of, or because of this, or, you know, in response, you know, he always has these conjunctions. He has no conjunction here. Here is a section that starts out with absolutely, he doesn't repeat the verb peripateo, walk. He doesn't repeat the word un that he does so often to say therefore, or in light of this. Here he goes directly from this participle here in 21, subjecting yourself to one another in fear of God, right to verse 22, wives. Okay, so I think that Paul is intentionally saying this is the next direct application of this point. He's not even separating this out. He's not saying, okay, you walk in love, you walk in wisdom, you be filled by the Spirit. Okay, now in light of all that, here's another situation. No, I think that what he said about being filled by the Spirit and being together in psalms and hymns and inspired songs and submitting yourself to one another, that this is the natural, direct thing of this. Now we're going to see how to do this submitting to one another in fear of God in these particular relationships, not in a corporate setting, but an individual setting. Okay, so that's the setup. That's how I think he's going here. What causes a problem is that we read this 2,000 years removed, okay? And it is very, very difficult to read this stuff and not bring some of that stuff we carry with us now into the text, okay? It's absolutely impossible. This first section about husbands and wives has been grossly abused forever within the church. By everybody. It's been grossly abused by men who want to just grind women under their thumb. And they go to the Bible and say, there you go, that's proof. You got to submit to me, honey. Okay? It's been used by women in the late 20th century and into the 21st century as a way to say, well, you see, the Bible is not relevant anymore because we know that a woman is equal and just as strong or even better than men, and so I want to bring feminist theology into the church, and I want to discount the Bible because the way I know life ought to be ain't what the text says, so that we've got to discount the text. And it's wrong on either count. It is wrong to use any text of the Bible to oppress anybody. It's wrong to discount the Bible because it doesn't particularly agree with your current social or political viewpoint. Now, I've always said, I've been real open about this, I struggle with a lot of what the Bible says about women's roles in the church and in the home. And mainly that struggle is because of my wife. I have an incredible wife. I say this when I talk about her. She's awesome. My wife is frequently smarter than me. She is a heck of a lot better looking than me, which is not tough to do, but she really is good looking. And I look at her and I think, why would God say, well, you know, just because you're a woman, I'm not going to put you in positions where you can really make some absolutely positive contributions within the church. Because she's brilliant. She's my wife is this we call her the VP at home. She's this big corporate business genius. My wife is most. I have two people in my life that I go to for business advice: my best friend and my wife. And both of these people are unbelievably just naturally talented business people. And I look at the Bible and I say, why would we pick a guy to do some of this stuff and not my wife? But yet the Bible says you got to have a guy to do some of this stuff, and women really shouldn't be in those positions. My wife doesn't struggle with this. I'm the one that does. And so my paradigm of seeing my wife and knowing her talents and abilities and reading the text, I really struggle with some of these things. So, but I, on the other hand, I know I can't take these passages and discount them and say, well, I have to throw out the Bible just because how I feel about my wife. Well, that's not right either. So, you know, what we have to do is we have to dig in there and say, okay, how do we understand this? We know the Bible's right, but we know our perceptions are right sometimes, right? Because God gave us a mind to figure a lot of this stuff out. So how do we reconcile these things? So that's a passage that we're going to have to deal with. Now, I'm going to deal with that a lot tonight. I think I actually have resolved this passage fairly well. And my wife still stays married to me, so I apparently am not getting in any trouble at home with my views on this. We have a lot of trouble with the parent-child thing, because most of us have had relatively good relationships with our parents or with our children, but there are times where we don't, where you just get ugly family dysfunction. And not that, you know, you grow up in this on a Springer show kind of family, but, you know, sometimes it's just not that good. And so you go, well, how do I deal with this? I had a good friend of mine, he's actually a Roman Catholic priest, who always says that the problem that most people have when they have a struggle with God is directly related to the relationship to their dad. And that you can almost always see that. If you have whatever your deal with your dad is, that seems to be, as an adult, how your deal with God is. And so we have this parent-child thing that doesn't quite look as smooth as Paul might say. And nowadays, you know, you have a lot of behavioral psychology that would discount what Paul has written here. And then it gets really ugly when you get into these issues of slave and master. And that one is tough because, boy, there's just a whole lot of ugliness related to that social structure. And it's hard for us in America to understand that the slave-master relationship in Paul's day, based on Roman society, was very different than ours. Sometimes it was very ugly and bad, but sometimes it was really good. And so that's, again, something. And in fact, we even say, well, how can this even be in the Bible? How can the Bible condone, and not just Paul should just flat out say, well, there should be no slavery? So you can see that these things, when we look at with our modern thought, with the way we understand the world, it's very hard to go to these texts. And so it's normal that we would struggle through some of this. So I think the way that we get around this, a couple different things. Number one, we have to honestly approach the text for what it really says. We can't make up what we want the text to say. Whether we're okay with that or not, we have to give the text its due. Number two, we do have to understand that some of this stuff in our current society, just we have to adapt it to that. And we have to understand the context of the society that Paul lived in. We have to understand what a slave-master relationship in the first century in Greco-Roman society looked like to understand what Paul was saying. We can't tell Paul, well, you should have said this, because we have to understand the historical context. But the main thing out of all of this is this verse 21, that this idea of subjecting yourselves to one another in the fear of God. This is the key for all of this. This is what Paul says, and remember, this isn't just Paul, he didn't just get up one morning and decide he was going to be Dr. Phil, you know, for the Ephesian church. Paul was led by God under the supervision of the Holy Spirit so that these words got into the Bible. And so what we have is submitting yourself to one another in the fear of God. It is mutual submission that is the key that unlocks all of these three relationship areas. As long as we keep that in mind, then we can understand what Paul's saying. So, let's look at the first section. There is an interesting thing in the text here This verse 22, wives, submit yourselves, subject yourselves to your husbands as to the Lord. Okay? And that, right off the bat, you know, that's the one gets everybody all fired up. Well, it's interesting because a lot of manuscripts don't have that word, submit yourself, in them. A lot of manuscripts leave that word out.
Submit?
Yeah. So in a lot of manuscripts, what you get going from verse 21 to 22 is submitting to one another in the fear of God. Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord. Well, that makes sense if we understand that, and we do in English if we hear it that way, that that word submitting from verse 21, Paul is just saying, okay, I just said that, we have to submit ourselves. Okay, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Okay, so it's not that Paul is singling out wives. Now, whether that is a scribal addition because they went, Paul left the verb out here, or not, you can debate that. And I spent a whole lot of time last week discussing how we figure out what text is what. And in this case, some folks have said it fits and other folks say it doesn't. But either way, I think Paul's talking about that. He's saying, wives, you have to submit to your husband. Yeah.
Shed a little light on the word submit.
Sure.
I think I've read that word relates to like the military concept of submitting. You know, like you're saying, you know, people
right.
get upset. You know, especially in today's term society. You know, women. You know, wives submit yourself to your husband.
Right.
But I think I'd like to know from a Greek perspective. What does that word submit really
right,
mean?
Right, right. Well, there's actually two words. Paul uses a different word when he talks about children and parents and when he talks about slaves and masters. In that case, he's using hupakuo. In this case, he's using hupatasso. Okay? Now, both of these words have a general meaning of submit or to subject yourself. But they have slightly different shades of meaning. I don't make it, by the way, my own personal opinion, I don't make that big a deal that somehow it's a different submission for wives and different for children and slaves and masters because he uses two different words. I think Paul's just using vocabulary to make this, it's just a literary device. But these two words, hupakuo means to obey. And that's the phrase that's used, that's the verb that's used in 6:1 and there again in 6:5. Okay, so hupakuo, that means to obey. And that's the same, the Greek there, to obey, means the exact same thing as the English to obey, right? We've talked about that. Obedience comes from giving authority or recognizing the authority of a certain person, right? I talked about that in the Greek when we see that word, like over in John 3:36, where we see the idea that obedience really means not be persuaded, right? It's apatheo. But this word, hupakuo, means to obey. So it means that you give authority to a certain person to what they say and to what they do, and so you follow what that person tells you to do. You obey them. This word, hupatasso, here in 22, has a slightly different meaning. It means to subject yourself to the person, to put yourself under the charge of that person, or to submit. Now, this hupatasso is the same word that's used in verse 21. So Paul is clearly, when he says submit to one another, this is the word that he uses, hupatasso, and it means to submit. And honestly, there are some situations in the Koine where the word does mean something slightly less than to say I'm going to submit to your authority, or I'm going to basically do what you say or let you be the head. But in general, in the Koine, it really does mean to submit in the same manner that in English we believe we would say someone submits to authority. I submit to the authority of my local government, right? If the city comes out and says you need to you know, move that thing off of your front lawn or we're going to fine you, well, I have to submit to their authority over me because they're my local government. I definitely submit to the authority of law enforcement because, well, they have guns. and they can throw me in jail, and I don't want either one of those things. So I submit to that authority. I submit to the authority within my local church, the elder board and our senior pastor. I believe that that's biblical. So I gladly tell my senior pastor, my elder board, I am completely available to you, to whatever you want me to do within the church. If you want me to go teach a class, if you want me to do this. Now, it's interesting in that relationship that I fully submit to them. I will do what they ask. Right. Now, that they don't view me as some pawn on a chessboard. You know, they'll say, hey, we'd like you to, you know, there was a class they wanted me to teach, it was a basic theology class. And I said, I'm more than happy to do that. And they said, are you sure you want, because we, and so there, I was submitting to their authority, but they were also recognizing that well, yeah, they need me to do this teaching work, and they see my value within our community. So, but submission is still submission. It means that person is an authority. So we really can't rely on the word there telling us anything other than what it kind of says in English. When it says, wives, submit to your husbands, it really means that. But there's an interesting thing about the Greek here that I think this is an interesting point. I said that it's not in every manuscript. When it does occur, it occurs in two different ways in different manuscripts. Some manuscripts have the verb in the passive voice. Other manuscripts have it in the middle voice. To me, this is important. I believe that those manuscripts that have in the passive voice, I believe that that's a scribal error and that's incorrect. The majority of text critics would say that the word does belong in the text and it should be in the middle voice. And that's most translations have it in the middle voice in the text. What's the difference between passive and middle voice? If it's passive voice, it means that the person is being forced to submit. So Paul would be saying, whether you like this or not, ladies, you are forced to submit to your husbands. That's if it's in the passive voice. Most scholars disagree with that, by the way. They think that's wrong. They think that's a scribe has added that at some point, and that's not correct. They believe that the form in the middle voice is the correct form. In other words, it's what Paul intended there. In the middle voice, remember we've talked about this, in English we have active and passive. I do something, I receive action of something, right? Tom hits the ball hits Tom. In one case, Tom's hitting the ball, in the other case, the ball's hitting Tom. He's receiving it, right? Greek has the middle voice. The middle voice means that the person is, the subject is both doing the action as well as receiving the results of the action. In this case, it would mean that wives are to voluntarily, in other words, from their own perspective, put themselves in a position of being subject to their husbands. They are not being forced to do it. It is what they are choosing to do in this action. That, I think, is very important. Because what Paul is saying here is what God has structured, the Holy Spirit's telling us this is how God wants life to look. And what Paul is saying here is that it's not that God is saying, I'm forcing you in these situations, but he's saying, you are to make this choice. Just like we have a choice to submit ourselves to Christ, or we can rebel. On a weekly basis, I'm sort of 50-50. Sometimes I submit real well, other times I'm pretty rebellious, right? But the middle voice here, I think, is important because it's saying that this submission is done on a voluntary basis. It is the choice of the woman to submit to the husband. It is not an involuntary situation. You know, salvation is always passive, right? We don't save ourselves. Salvation is always passive in the New Testament because it's God doing to us, okay? Here, that's not the case. The middle voice here, I think, is pointing us in that direction.
Does the middle voice always indicate choice?
Well, the middle voice has a range of usage. Okay. Sometimes it's purely reflexive. I'm doing the action to myself. Mm-hmm. Okay. In this case, that wouldn't apply because they're not subjecting to themselves. Mm-hmm. So in this case, yeah, it would be a voluntary sort of choice issue. There are some other applications of the middle voice, but they really don't apply here. That seems to be the one that applies most commonly here. And I think it's kind of if we're looking at grammar to help us here, that's an important way to look at it. Now, there's another view. If you have Hohner's commentary, you'll see that he goes into a very detailed excursus on what's called, it's sort of a structure of the family and how the family's supposed to be structured. And we believe that that's a historical cultural context for this, that there's a particular family order that Paul is using here. But I think Paul's doing something even more than this, and I want to take a look at this. I want to look at this passage not starting out with this idea, but looking at this idea of what verse 21 says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. I want to look at this in a broader biblical perspective. So in order to do this, we need to go to Genesis. Okay? Genesis 3. And down there to Genesis 3, it's the fall of man. Not the spring or summer of man, but the fall of man. He has a bad play on words.
Genesis 3,
we know the story, right? Adam and Eve, they're having a fine time in the garden. God says, you can do anything you want, just don't eat the fruit of that tree. And sure enough, they eat the fruit of the tree. Gosh, had it turned out different, we'd all be living the life of Riley right now, right? But so they ate fruit of the tree, and they get cursed, okay? And so in chapter 3, God curses everybody in the situation. He is an equal opportunity curser here. He curses the serpent, right? Because it deceived him. Then he curses the woman, and he curses the man. Now, I think what's important here is to look at the curse of the woman. Remember when they sinned. Okay, we get this sort of weird... This is one of those stories. The fall is one of those stories that we have heard forever, right? Even before any of us were Christians, we would still hear that story. That is a story that is in Western thought. And everybody knows the fall of man. I mean, if you ask anybody, what's the story of Adam and Eve? They'll go, oh, well, I know the story of Adam and Eve. You know, they were in the garden, and the serpent talked to Eve and said, you should eat this fruit. And she went, oh, cool, and she ate it. And then she ran back and gave it to her husband, and he ate it, and then they both got kicked out of the garden. Right? Everybody knows the story. That's not actually what the biblical story is. In when you read the biblical story, Adam is standing right next to Eve at the time. So Adam has every chance in the world to go, hey, snake, you get away from my wife. Honey, don't listen to this guy. Let's go over here and have an avocado instead, right? Adam doesn't do anything. If he wasn't naked, I'd say he was standing with his hands in his pockets, but they weren't wearing clothes, apparently. So he was just standing there, and I don't know what he was doing, but he didn't do anything to stop this, right? And remember, Adam and Eve were made both equal in the image and likeness of God. So it was a complete equal situation there, and Adam didn't do anything. It wasn't that he was just back sitting in the lazy boy watching the game and not paying attention, and Eve came in and said, here, eat this, and he went, yeah, and he took a bite, right? Adam is not a completely guiltless individual here. In the story, he's standing right there when this occurs. But anyway, they sin. They get kicked out, and they get cursed. And this is what's applicable to us now, this curse. So in chapter 3 in Genesis, starting in verse 16. To the woman, he said, and this is God, right? He says, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Okay. Well, it's interesting because our English translations, I think, are very poor here. Most English translations, almost all English translations, really miss what the Hebrew is doing here. This greatly increase your pain in childbearing. That's interesting because that word in Hebrew isn't just about giving birth. That word actually has the connotation of conception through childbirth. So it's interesting that what God is saying here, he's going to greatly increase your pain from conception through birth. I've had two kids. I've been at both ends of the chain, conception and birth. Birth was a lot more painful than conception, okay? I'm just saying. Why would he say that? Well, it appears that there's something more than just the physical pain of childbirth here. That what God is saying is he's going to greatly increase your pain in this entire process of conception through birth. Then the next thing, and here I think the English translations completely miss the thing. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, I had a young couple come to me. They were in my Sunday school class, and they were engaged to be married. They're going to be married in about a month. And the fiancé, the wife, a future wife, came up to me, and she said, "I'm really struggling with this passage. I really desire my husband. I absolutely love him. I am looking forward to our wedding. I'm really looking forward to the honeymoon. Why is this a curse over me? I mean, aren't I supposed to love my husband? Aren't I supposed to desire him above all other men? I mean, why am I cursed?" And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So I started looking this up. And I started looking, what does the Hebrew say there? That word desire is an interesting word. It's only used twice. It's used again over in Genesis 4, verse 7. The Lord's talking to Cain here. I'll start in verse 6. Genesis chapter 4, verse 6. "Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it.'" Well, that seems like a different desire than this young lady had for her fiancé. Here, the desire, sin is the thing with the desire. The object is, in this case, Cain, right? And the result of that desire is that it desires to have you, but he tells Cain, you must master that thing that's desiring you. So it seems that this idea of desire is not just, you know, boy, I desire my husband. He's just a great guy. I just want to hang out with him. He's smart and good looking and fun and whatever, right? Here it looks like there's something else going on. Now, in the Hebrew, in verse 16, Hebrew doesn't use verbs the same way we do in English. This used to really mess me up. In first year Hebrew, I really had a hard time because I was struggling not finding the verb to be places where I really wanted it, okay, when I was dealing with Hebrew. And it seems like knowing what this word desire means and the structure of this verse 6, what the Hebrew is really saying there, in light of the curse that the whole, not just childbirth, but conception through childbirth is going to be difficult, so that's a relationship thing, right? It appears that what God is saying is that as a result of the fall, Eve, in the fall herself, her will overrode the will of her husband. You know, he just shut up and let her eat the apple and listen to the snake, right? And then he ate the apple. Eve sort of said, this is what we're going to do, and Adam went along with it. Well, God's curse to Eve is that she will desire to have her will in that relationship, but yet her husband will rule over her. He will stop her will. So she won't get her way, he'll get his way. So it seems that what the curse in Genesis 3 is that the curse is that relationships are going to be broken. Relationship is going to be one person trying to put their will over on the other person, and the other person trying to stifle the other person's will with their own will. So that the picture of relationship coming out of Genesis 3 is that men and women are going to be in this huge struggle to dominate each other with their will. And that makes a lot more sense coming out of the relationship of Adam and Eve in the fall. And what God curses Eve in this whole idea of having children from conception through birth is going to be painful, it makes a lot of sense then that we understand that what that passage says is that the curse is not that I'll just like my husband. Gosh, I hope my wife doesn't feel cursed because she likes me. But rather that relationships are going to be cursed because they're broken. They're dysfunctional. the woman is going to want to have her way, and the guy is going to dominate and say, no, I'm getting my way. And that's going to frustrate her, and so she's going to want to have her way. And he's going to put her down again and say, no, it's my way. And this is the picture of broken relationships coming out of the fall. Now, I believe that the Hebrew there supports this. Grammatically and lexically, I believe that this supports it. So what does that mean? That means that relationships are broken because of the fall.
But how does that relate to Cain?
Well, that's what we're going to see. The relationship between men and women is going to be broken. The relationship of Cain and Abel, when we see over there, the relationship there is, again, that desire to conquer sin. God is warning him. He says, look it. He said, if you do what's right, you'll be accepted, right? But he says, if you do not do what's right, if you're following your own path, sin is desiring to have you, but you need to master it. So now he's showing us a negative situation that Cain is going to have this desire to do his own will. Sin is going to want to get him. But what Cain has to do is he has to master that negative desire, that will. That's the picture of all of us, right? I mean, isn't that what we do on... Well, maybe you guys are better than me. I know. I frequently deal with this, trying to master that desire of sin, right? And so it's that same sort of fight that is going on between men and women, between husbands and wives, that the wife is going to want her way, and the husband's going to have his way, and that's going to frustrate her, it's going to frustrate him, so he's going to demand more, she's going to demand more, and so you get this ugly, broken cycle of relationship. But the cross redeemed everything.
Remember when Jesus told Peter that Satan desires to have you?
Mm-hmm.
That he may sift you as wheat, but I pray for you? Is that it sounds like it's a similar thing there also?
I think it's similar to what he was telling Cain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to what God was telling Cain.
Right.
But in the relationships, mm-hmm. we have this broken relationship of a battle of the wills, and then we get to the cross, and it's redeemed. And I think what Paul is telling us here in Ephesians 5:22, actually 5:21, but forward into 5:22, this is what relationships look like when they're redeemed. An unredeemed relationship in a sinful, fallen world is one where both parties are going to demand their right and their will. A redeemed relationship is one where there's mutual submission. A redeemed relationship coming from the cross is where we look to do what is best for the other person in that relationship. Where we look to model the relationship that Christ has with us in all of our relationships. So a relationship that was destroyed by sin has now been redeemed at the cross. And in light of that, Paul is telling us this is what this new redeemed relationship looks like. It's a relationship now where we submit to one another in the fear of God. Okay? So now we say, okay, let's look at this wife submit to your husband through that lens. Let's look at what that looks like as the repaired version of what was broken in the fall. Well, if we do that, then this passage makes a whole lot of sense because we have two parties here. Paul doesn't just end this saying, wives submit to your husbands. Now let's go on to something else. Paul says, wives submit to your husbands. But then he tells the husbands, you're to love your wife as your own body. You're to love your wife the way Christ loved the church. That's a huge thing. That's mutual submission in a very spiritual terms, right? Wives are to submit to their husbands as they submit to God. The husband is to love the wife as Christ loves the church. Right there, that's the perfect marriage. Okay, that's what a perfect male-female relationship looks like. If you truly have that, then you have the redeemed relationship. Not the relationship that came out of the fall where you're battling to have your will over the other person. You see what I'm saying here? So I think that we have to look at this as the redemption of relationship that was destroyed in the fall. That curse in Genesis 3 is now shown to be redeemed and straightened out here in this passage. Now, there's another important thing to view here. This does not mean that either party is inferior or superior. Now, and there's proof that Paul doesn't believe this. See, Paul is not a misogynist. Paul is not this guy that hates women, right? We know Paul never got married. And a lot of folks say, oh, the guy had no clue what marriage is like, right? I don't believe Paul got married. We know Peter was married. That's right. The first pope had a wife and a mother-in-law. And the current pope is lucky he doesn't have a mother-in-law, but he could like the wife. No, I have to tell you, besides having an incredible wife, I have an awesome mother-in-law. She'll never listen to this, but she is. This woman is incredible. I really lucked out. So I have a great mother-in-law. But what Paul views men and women in the marriage relationship as absolute equals. And we have to keep that in mind. Paul is not saying, I hate women, so I want them under the man's thumb. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Okay. First Corinthians chapter 2. Let's see. Okay. That's not right. 1 Corinthians. Okay, where is this? Well, that's not the passage I want at all. Why am I missing this? Let's go to 1 Corinthians. It's not 12. Is it 2 Corinthians? Did I write my note to myself wrong?
2 Corinthians 2?
Let's take a look at 2 Corinthians 2. Well, that's not it either.
What are you looking for?
I am looking for the passage in maybe it's 1 Corinthians 4. Maybe that's it. Let's look there. We'll just be all over the Bible here for a moment. Well, I will have to find it at the break, but what Paul is saying is Paul is talking to husbands and wives. And he's saying, now look it, do not withhold your affections from each other. And Paul is not just talking about smooching and holding hands here, right? Paul says, do not withhold your affections from one another, because that's going to really cause a problem. One, it's going to cause you to fall into sin. But then Paul makes a statement. He says, wives, you don't own your own body. Your husband is the owner of your body. And then he turns and he says, husbands, you don't own your own body. Your wives own your body. You see, Paul views the relationship of husband and wives to be so completely intimate and equal. Did we find it?
In 7:12.
I have 1 Corinthians 7.
1 Corinthians 7. Oh, maybe that's it. 1 Corinthians 7. Let's take a look there. There we go. That's it. Thank you. I don't know why I put 2 in my note. Maybe I just. There's no excuse. See, I'm infallible. Except for those mistakes that I make. Okay, so here he says in verse 9, concerning things which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. That's more of the... more talking about in a marriage context. He says, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband. Notice it's not just let each man go out and get married. Paul is saying, let each man have his own wife, let each woman have her own husband. There's an equality there, the way Paul states that. Let the husband to the render his wife the affection due her, likewise the wife to her husband. Again, he's seeing equality in the relationship here. It's not just let the husband receive the affection of the wife, and if he's kind, he can show her affection. He's showing equally. Then here's the statement, and this is radical for the first century, folks. Okay? The wife does not have authority over her own body, but her husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. This is huge. This is showing absolute equality in a husband and wife. You can't read that passage and get anything else from it. The grammar, the lexical range of the words, they all mean exactly what it says in English. That the wife does not have authority over her own body, the husband does. The husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Okay, we jump back here to Ephesians. If Paul thinks that's true, then this concept of wives submitting to their husbands and husbands loving the wife is purely one within this mutual submissive relationship. It is one where two equals take their role that God has presented here, and that's how they live in the relationship. Now, it's interesting that Paul goes on. He spends a lot of time on this husband and wife thing. He goes on over and over again to talk about how that the husband is to love the wife as his own body, right? Right, we're back in Ephesians 5:28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. So if you read this to be a carte blanche for a man to reign supreme over his wife, then you got to leave out verse 28 and 29, right? Because we nurture our own bodies. In fact, we're frequently so kind to ourselves that we don't do the things that are good for ourselves. I'm not a big fan of heavy exercise, but I know that's good for me, but there are times where I'd much rather sit on the couch and watch a baseball game, right? But I have to do those things that are good for my body. Frequently, I try to be so good to myself that I end up not doing the good stuff, right? But what Paul is saying here is I've got to love my wife as if I'm loving myself. So Paul tells us in Corinthians that the relationship to husband and wife is perfectly equal. They own each other physically. He tells us here that we're to live mutually submissive lives, and the way God has pictured this in relationship as a redeemed version of what was broken in the fall is that the wife will submit to her husband as she submits to the Lord, and the husband is to love his wife as Christ loves the church. So the perfect model of this mutual submissive relationship is this relationship of the church and Christ, and of us and God. And in that context, it is impossible to take this in any of the negative ways that this passage is always used, because this is the picture of mutual submission. Okay, now, after the break, we're going to take a look at how this looks for parent and children, and how it looks for slaves and masters, or I believe more appropriately for us, in employee-employee relationships. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back and pick up after that. All right. I'll tell one funny story here. I always tell when I teach on this passage in Ephesians. When I was in seminary in intermediate Greek, second year Greek, we study Ephesians and spend a lot of time with it. And so one evening I was sitting there at my dining room table doing my homework, and I was translating this passage, chapter 5, verses 22 and following, and I was translating them and working through it. And my wife came over and she said, "Oh, what are you doing?" I said, "Oh," and I figured I was going to really get her. I said, "Oh, well, I'm translating my favorite passage of Scripture, honey. Wives, be submissive to your husbands." And she just laughed and she said, "Well," she said, "you know, if you read further, it says that you have to treat me like Christ did the church. And, you know, he died for the church." And I said, "You know, you're right, sweetie. In our relationship, if you ever submitted to me, I'd just up and keel over and die if it happened." So and she always then kind of gives me that wifey look, you know, when I tell that story. But the next passage of Scripture that is usually frequently brought up in my household is over in Ephesians, in chapter 6. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. My kids bring that up all the time, usually when I'm doing something to annoy them. the second section of Ephesians is actually nobody seems to have any difficulty with this, that that children are to obey parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, interesting, Paul says here, honor your father and mother, which is the only or first commandment that has a promise with it. So kids are, he's sort of enjoining the kids, look, if for no other reason, be good to your parents because you get a blessing out of it. But it's not, again, it's not a call for children to blindly follow their parents. There are situations, and it's hugely unfortunate, but we live in a fallen world where parents are not good at being parents. And the extreme is that parents actually cause harm to their children. So this is not to say that the Bible condones children being in hugely dysfunctional, abusive relationships, that I don't care how bad he beat you, you have to obey him because he's your father. That's not what this is saying. This is, again, seeing in these mutual submissive relationships, everybody has a role to play. And in this case, the children are to honor their parents. Now, a lot of times where this becomes tough is as adults. You know, you grow up with a parent that's not so great, right? They're doing the best they can, but it's just not great. And you grow up and you go, man, I am so glad I'm out of there. I'm on my own. Forget you, mom and dad, or mom or dad, whoever you have a problem with. What this is saying, and what the original commandment over in Exodus is saying, is not that we are to blindly, you know, so, okay, well, I don't care how abusive that adult parent is to me as an adult child, but it's saying that we are to obey and honor them. So I'm still to care for them. I'm still to make sure that, that if they're old and getting senile or having Alzheimer's, that I provide care. And even though I may not just sit there and, you know, it's not like a 50s sitcom where I'm just gazing lovingly at my parent. I'm lucky. I had great parents. My dad passed away. My mom's still alive. But I know some folks that struggle with their relationship with their parents, and this means that we're to still honor them in a way that we care for them, especially if your parents are believers. If they're not a believer, this doesn't give you carte blanche to just ignore them, by the way, just because this is written about believer relationships. I think it's even more important that you honor your parent in that situation in the way that a believing spouse is to honor their spouse in order to bring them to the Lord. So this one's pretty straightforward, but the again, the other side of this, and although he just says fathers, this applies to moms too, is that the relationship of the parent is to care and nurture the child. Do not provoke them, but nourish them in discipline and instruction of the Lord. So both parties have a relationship responsibility here. Now, some folks, again, only have the child side of that relationship. If you do not have children of your own as you grow up, you only have that child-to-parent side. Other folks who have kids, like myself, I've got a couple of kids, I experience this relationship from both sides. So I both have my relationship with my parents as well as my relationship as a parent to my children. So, you know, as a believer in that situation, you end up on both sides of this coin. The wife and husband thing, I'm never going to be a wife. I'd be a terrible wife, by the way. Not only am I not very attractive, but I'd just be a lousy wife. So in that one, we only get one side of it. But in this one, we could actually experience both sides. Frequently, if we've had a difficult relationship with our parents, when we become parents, we get a do-over. And we're able to really experience a great relationship of that parent-child as we are parents. So a lot of times that's very healing. The other thing is, again, for people who have children, this was my experience, I came to understand very clearly my relationship with God by looking at my relationship with my children. Because at those points of time where my children vexed me and I was frustrated, I still had this incredible love because they were my kids. And I had to deal with that. I had to discipline and for their own good, but I also had to show them that I love them unconditionally, and even though my discipline was there for them, it was not a sign that I didn't love them. And for me, that was a huge slap upside of the head to say, wow, that's your relationship with God, you know. That even though there are times where I vex God and he needs to discipline me, there is never a point where he does not unconditionally love me because I'm his adopted kid. I mean, that's what Paul says. So we see this situation is usually the easiest of the three to look at, and it has a huge a range of stuff that we can look at in terms of those relationships. Yeah.
What do you do when in a situation dealing with the children obeying parents? Okay, my dad, before he passed away, he used to always quote the scripture. Okay, with regards to me and my siblings.
Right.
You know, we used to quote to him, "The fathers don't provoke."
Yes.
You know, your children to anger. But he always thought, interpreted that part of the script, the children part, as even for his adult children, as, you know, as you would an adolescent or you know.
Right.
And so, you know, and I don't to this day, I don't understand why he had a conflict with that concept of that word children. You know, instead of looking at his adult children as being adults, he still become his quote unquote children. So, what does the Greek have to say about that? That word children.
The word children there is techna. There are two words that are predominantly used for children in the New Testament, padion and techna. One has a tendency to mean smaller, younger, baby kind of child. A techna is a, sort of just a generic child, young person sort of thing. You know, that is difficult. I've always told my daughter, I have a wonderful daughter. She turns 17 here in another 2 weeks. And she's beautiful and she's wonderful. And I always told her, I'm sorry, honey, I need to tell you that no matter how old or however you go in life, I will always think of you as about a little 11-year-old kid sitting on my lap. That's just how I am. I'm sorry. When you're 50 running a company or being, you know, a doctor or a veterinarian over in Africa or all the things that she talks about doing, you're still going to be that beautiful little child. So I said, I'm sorry. Let me apologize up front, you know. But that's kind of normal. I think what happens, though, here is that in this passage, what we need to look at are two things. One, we live in a fallen world, and we are sinners, even though we're believers, even though we have eternal life. We're still sinners. I mean, the Bible tells us if we say we're without sin, we lie and we make God a liar, right? So Paul presents how God wants it to be, but we're not going to hit that mark all the time. So there are going to be situations where kids just aren't good kids and where parents just aren't good parents, or where they do things that, oh man, that's just not the way it should be. So we have to understand that. That's just how it is. That's why Paul tells us to be transformed, to live in the power of the Spirit, that we rely on God to overcome those things. The second thing here, though, that I think Paul does, and I think this is important in the text, the word child really just means child here, and I think in a fairly generic sense, ranging anywhere from little babies up to children when they become adult age. But I think what Paul says here is, in verse 2, he quotes from the Decalogue, right? He quotes, he says, honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. Well, that concept of honor your father and mother, really, I think what Paul is saying there is that what a child needs to do is, even when you no longer have that dependent relationship of, let's say, that a five-year-old has with its parent, or even a teenager might have with their parent, that the child's responsibility is to still honor the parent in a way that is respectful and of that person as both as a person, but as that relationship of the one who raised that child. And the parent, I think, needs to, this do not vex your children, do not make them angry, I think has to look at it in that same way, that it's tied to this honor father and mother idea, that you'll never change that relationship. Your children will always be your children. You know, it's impossible to not, you know, you just can't forget what the kid was like when they were five, even though they're 35. They were still five, and you remember that because they were in your house. And so I think you always have the parent doing that. Where I think the mutual submission comes in is that even though I remember the little knucklehead the kid was when he was five, at 35, I have to respect the man or woman that is. And And even though that relationship is still there, I still can't do something to make them angry. That's still wrong, even though they're no longer a little child. But they still need to also honor the parent, even though they're now a grown-up out on their own individual with their own family. They still need to honor the parent in that same way. So I think that by quoting the Old Testament there, Paul is broadening this out beyond just the young child, older parent situation. I think where it falls apart is, again, through our own sinful nature, where we, for whatever reason, we bend those relationships. In the same way that a husband and wife mutual submission can be bent out of shape by a husband wanting to be domineering or a wife wanting to manipulate the husband, I think these parent-child relationships can be broken as well through sin. The final one is servants and masters. Again, I believe that this is more applicable for us to talk about in the relationship of employer and employee, but I do need to touch on this. The difficult thing in the Bible is that nowhere does it tell the New Testament Christians to not participate in slavery. It doesn't tell masters, stop, let all your slaves go. It doesn't tell the slaves, ignore your masters, go on your own. The New Testament does not condemn the societal structure of a slave and a master. And that's very difficult, okay? It's extremely difficult that it doesn't condemn that. So we have to be honest with the text and say, well, why is that the case? Well, I think a very good and easy answer is that that relationship within the society in Greco-Roman society was very different than what we here in America view. The slave-master relationship in America was terrible. It is one of the huge and ugly things about America. And we still to this day pay for that. As far as we've gone, we still pay for that. And it was terrible and ugly, and there was nothing good about it. That's not what slavery looked like in the first century. At this period of time, Roman population, there was a greater number of slaves in the population of Rome than there were free men. Slaves in Rome, while some were treated just like trash, and they were just, used at the lowest possible level in society, there was that aspect of it, as in all societies, as there always will be. You cannot, in sinful man, in a society that does not look to God, there's always going to be oppression of some group by some other group. That's part of the sin of man. But in Roman society, you did have a certain group that were treated just like garbage, and they were killed off in the Colosseum and in the games and whatnot. But the larger percentage of slaves actually were people that functioned at a very high level in society. When Rome would conquer another group, they would take the artisans and the doctors and the philosophers and the lawyers and all the really cultured people and the people that made things, chairs and plaster and everything, and they would bring them in and put them to work in the society doing those things and give them honored positions. Within a household would have, most wealthy households would have a couple of people who were in a slave relationship in that household. Frequently, these were the people that ran the household. They functioned, they were the ones that did the banking and the crafts and everything in the household. And they were trained individuals wherever they came from and adopted into this. And then at a certain point, you could get out of this. You could buy your way out, you could get out of it through being in it just a certain period of time. So it was very different than the model that we see in America, which was just ugly. And so when we read this, we have to understand that when the New Testament talks about this slave and master relationship, it's what we see in the first century Roman society, not what we see in the 17th and 18th century in America. It's just not. It's not the same thing. So how do we do this? Because we don't have that anyway. I mean, we don't have, I'm not captured and taken to Oregon to work as a graphic artist for some household in a slave relationship. Nobody comes down and conquers California, Fountain Valley, and takes me away, right? So this slave-master thing, what does it look like for us? Well, we have sort of a voluntary version of this in terms of employment, okay? We have certain skills, and we go to a company and say, I want to offer you my skills. And the company says, all right, we want to use your skills. So now we're going to set up a contractual basis where we are going to essentially take you and use your skills for us through a basic period of time, X number of hours per week. But if we need more, we expect you to work more. We'll tell you when you can or can't work. You know, you have to apply for your vacation. We'll give you a certain amount of days to be sick, but if you run out of those days, you know, that's... And then we're going to pay you a certain amount of money. But only that. And if you want more money, you have to come over and we have to renegotiate this deal. Well, that's as close as we get in our society to what Paul had in the first century. So when Paul talks about this idea of servants and masters, we can talk about employee and employers. And again, it's these same kind of things. Realizing that you are both serving each other, that you, these are mutually submissive relationships. In verse 5 here, bondservants, or I could say employees, be obedient to those who are your employers according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. Again, the model in each one of these on the submission side is that we act the same way to the person that we're submitting to in the way that we act to Christ. Wives, submit to your husband as to the Lord. Children, obey your parents as in the Lord. Bond servants, obey your masters as to Christ. So the model here of this submission is how we humble and submit ourselves to Christ. Remember when this whole section of the book started in chapter 4, there were three things that Paul said we were to be. Go back to chapter 4, verse 2. He said the three things, how we're to live our life, is we're to be humble, meek, and patient. Right? Chapter 4, verse 2. And that's the thesis statement, the whole second half of the book. So how are we to be meek, humble, and patient? Well, it's the same way we approach Christ. That's how we do these relationships. Now then, the it says, not just with eye service as a man-pleaser, but as bond servants of Christ doing the will of God from the heart. In other words, I'm not just going to, the minute my boss comes in and go, hey, how you doing, boss? Yeah, I'm working real hard here. Hey. And then he leaves. And I go, oh, phew, boy, I'm done. I'm going to play solitaire on my computer the rest of the afternoon. Because when you do that, you're robbing the employer. If an employer is paying you X amount of dollars an hour to do a job, and you don't do that job, then you're robbing that employer. That's a sin. Okay, and that's what Paul is saying. You're not just pleasing them. This is not just a light thing here. But then he says for the masters as well, you do the same things to them. Give up your threatening, knowing that your own master in heaven, there is no partiality with him. So here he's saying, look it, as an employer, or in this case the master with the slaves, I'm not to abuse the people that work for me. Now I have to tell you, again, to just talk about how wonderful my wife is. You'll be sick of this by the end of the evening. You'll be calling her up saying, Libby, I'm sick of this. She is, I think, the best boss in the world. I see how she cares for her employees. She's even been in situations where she has had to terminate an employee because the business has cut down. They've had to sell one of their, she works in the medical field, and they've had to sell one of their medical centers. And so she's had to let people go. And I have seen her agonizing and going into the HR department and fighting with them to get this person more severance pay or benefits that last, just tearing herself, gutting a knot over this kind of stuff. And she takes this very seriously, that when you're the employer and that person depends on you for their income, that pays their rent and buys their food and puts gas in their car, you have a huge responsibility. Your responsibility is to make that workplace, one, a safe and good environment, and two, to make sure that you're conscientious because you're providing the income that that person lives off of. So it's not just willy-nilly. You don't make their life hell. You treat them, though, again, the way God treats us. So this model of employer-employee is, again, this whole idea that we're to be mutually beneficial to each other. We're to do those things that respect the other person. Whether you're in the position of authority or in the position of submission, both of those carry huge responsibility. And Paul says that this being filled by the Spirit, this living your life, this is what it looks like. It's what it looks like as a husband and wife, or I think in a dating relationship, or I even think in a friendship, there should be mutual respect. But it's what it looks like as parent and child, and it's what it looks like as an employer employee. This is the very bottom line, rubber meets the road of how we're to live in this kind of spirit-filled life, this mutual submitting. Now, next week, we're going to get to the last part of Ephesians here. We're going to talk about the full armor of God. We're going to talk about kind of the battle that we're doing, that a lot of this that takes place while we're trying to do all this other stuff. But the key, again, for all that we talked about tonight is back here in verse 21, chapter 5, subjecting yourself to one another in the fear of God. It's mutual submission that is the hallmark of the Christian relationship in all aspects of relationship. All righty. See everybody next week.
Very good job.